and put in an area code, exchange code. It'll tell you exactly where it is in the country.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Elias here.
Hi, Elias. Hey, welcome. Glad you could make it, because this call would be pretty empty without you.
Sure.
Paul Zaremka's here.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
How you doing?
Hello. Hi, Paul.
Okay, well, let's see. So far, I've got Elias, Paul, John S., Barton, Michael, and Michael, or just Michael Booth. Anybody else here yet?
Craig McKee just joined.
Hey, Craig.
Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Robin Horton.
Robin Horton, who surprises us with an entry here. Okay, let's put him in. Robin Horton, we'll add you to the list. Okay, so far we don't. Barbara's not here. James Spetzer's not here. James Hufford's not here. Lawrence Fine is not here. Barry is here. Let me note him. John S. is here. Martin is not here. Craig and Ken and Barton and Michael Booth are here. Sheila's not here. Michael Cook's not here. Is that correct so far, or anybody want to correct that? Oh, and Elias is here, Craig. I know you came on late, but Elias is already here.
Oh, great.
Hi, who just joined us?
Hi, Mike Cook here.
Okay, Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Who's this? Is this Craig?
This is Ken Freeland.
Hey, Ken. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the invite.
Okay, well,
Hi, Mike, this is Craig. How are you doing?
Good, good.
We got about three or four people that said they were coming that aren't here yet, but I guess we can wait another minute or two. Yeah. If nobody minds, give them latecomers a chance to show up.
Am I listing John and Martin just with last initial? Is that the preference? Yeah.
Oh, no. Those are just from my notes. It's Martin McGee, who was the co-producer of Explosive Evidence, said he wanted to join us, so hopefully he'll be here later. And let's see, who's the other one?
John S.
Who's the other one? John. John, what was your last name, John?
John, if it's me, John Spritzler.
Well, John Spritzler, that's right. Just John Spritzler. Do you know John? Craig?
Maybe you, just to be safe, you could spell your last name for me, John, just so I don't get it wrong.
S-P-R-I-T as in Thomas, Z-L-E-R.
Got it. Great. Thank you.
Here's Elias. I invited John.
Great.
Well, I think we've waited long enough for folks to show up. I'm sure there'll be a few stragglers in, but let's go ahead and get started. I want to welcome Elias again to the call. He was with us last week when we were preparing this, but we're honored to have him with us and to share time with him to find out more about his work and his research and to have some discussion about some of the issues that he's raised. We want to especially thank Craig McKee for doing the footwork on this, and Paul and some other people that provided some help. And so since Craig took the initiative, we'd like to ask him to make the introduction. Go ahead, Craig.
Okay, sure. I'd also like to thank Elias for joining us. I'll just give you a couple of little bits of background. Elias was born in Palestine, now living in Germany. He's a musician and composer, as well as an author and expert in international law and human rights. He's written a number of articles on a variety of subjects, including Zionism, the World Bank, IMF, and he's been a prominent truth activist for a number of years, almost since the beginning. And as Ken mentioned, he in the notes that he sent.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hi there.
Gotcha.
Gotcha. Elias founded the first Icelandic 9/11 truth group, and most recently he published a book called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence. And in this study, he looks at evidence that Muslims were not responsible for the crimes of 9/11, that two of the flights were still airborne after they were supposed to have crashed, and that none of the alleged hijackers ever boarded any of the four flights. He also examines the evidence concerning the alleged calls from the planes, and he presents a theory for how this was done, plus a lot more, I can assure you. I'm in the middle of his book, and there's a lot of information there. So I'd just like to say welcome to Elias as well.
Okay.
So maybe pass it over to you to sort of introduce.
Should I take Thanks. Over?
One moment, please, Elias. Who just joined the call, please?
James Hufford.
Hey, James. Okay, welcome. Oh. Okay. We just did the introduction, and now Elias is going to give us a brief summary of his finding. Go ahead, Elias.
Great.
Okay. So, first of all, I'd like to thank for the invitation to address this conference call. I'm very, very pleased to talk directly to my friends and to you all, people whom I never met. Most of you I didn't never met in person, except Barry, who came once to Iceland. So I'm very pleased to able to talk like this with you. Well, Craig introduced me briefly, and I don't want to spend my time now to introduce my person and work. I would like to go directly into the issue which is now in front of us, which is to begin with the book which was published in New York in May, Al Gore. It is Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, which is not an introduction to 9/11. It is basically an advanced research into very specific aspects of 9/11. I'd like, just before I go into the matter of the book, I'd like to thank very much three people whose identities I don't really know, but who are blogging under the names of Woody Box, Killtown, and Shoestring. These people have been doing extremely good work, and some of that work has been helping me writing this book. So if those people are listening to this conversation, I would like just to thank them again for their incredible contributions. And of course, to all the other ones who are publishing openly, like David Ray Griffin, James Fetzer, Barry Tricker, and so many others who did excellent job. Now, in my work, I did not pretend and intend to cover all aspects of 9/11. There are aspects which have been covered extremely well by others who are much better informed than me, particularly the demise of the World Trade buildings, question of insider trading, questions of the Pentagon events, the work of the 9/11 Commission. All of these things I completely bypassed. Brought me, I in fact began to research 9/11 already 2002. What has always been tickling my curiosity is that I felt unease about the claim that 19 Muslims who did not suffer any particular trauma would accept to kill themselves for a vague political idea and execute an act of mass murder that is both contrary to Islam and would foreseeably hurt Muslims worldwide. I found that this kind of claim did not add up, but I did not know how to tackle it. So I began to search for evidence that this has been the case. So what I did is to put myself in the shoes of investigators and ask myself what kind of evidence I would look for to prove that these people actually committed the crime. Having chosen the method of investigation, I began to wonder what kind of evidence would prove the presence of these 19 people in the aircraft. So I set a list of 5 categories of evidence for which I began to look. First of all, passenger lists. Second, boarding cards. Third, video recordings of their boarding or their presence in the airport. Fourth, interviews with airline employees who were boarding the passengers. And fifth, an identification of their bodily remains from the crash site. So I began to search for all these documentation. And slowly it emerged that there is no such documentation. Nothing exists in any of these categories. The question of passenger lists was already researched partly early on, but I tried to to go further and to search all available sources which could eventually show the existence of authentic passenger lists. I also wrote to American Airlines, I wrote to the FBI. In every case, I received no. There was no passenger list available, no from nowhere, no authentic one. The same thing happened to boarding cards. Videos, I discovered 2 videos. One video from Portland, which everybody knows, and the other one from Dallas Airport, which many of you already are aware of, was very probably a fraudulent video. So we have already 3 types of category of evidence which were lacking. Now, interesting, no airline employee who boarded the passengers was interviewed, or at least there is no interview known of any of these people. And those who have been interviewed did not mention anything out of the ordinary, or were not confronted with the FBI showing them pictures, photographs of the alleged terrorist. So there was no evidence either from these people. And at the end of the day, the identification of body remains was conducted in such a way that the official response was that the identities were found by a method of exclusion, meaning those bodily remains which were not identified as belonging to the so-called passengers were automatically attributed to the alleged hijackers, which means that none of these hijackers were individually identified. So we have here a case of mass murder in which the United States government alleges that 19 individuals with names boarded aircraft and committed a mass murder. The United States government has not produced even the minimal kind of evidence which would be required just to put these people on board of these planes, let alone that these people committed the crime, because after all, they could be just innocent passengers, but even that does not exist. So basically, the entire 9/11 official account was therefore put in question. And I went one, some people would argue or have argued that the fact that the evidence does not exist does not mean that it does not exist somewhere in a drawer of the U.S. government. But we must, as citizens, presume that if the United States government did not produce the best evidence it possesses to prove its own case, then it means, and we must presume, that it does not possess that evidence. Such a presumption, of course, is rebuttable, but we must proceed from that presumption, that meaning that no Muslim terrorists committed the crime. Now, if anybody would like to say, well, this presumption is not correct, because it could be that they did, that person would have the burden to prove that they did, and that person would have to prove that the evidence somewhere exists. So this was my first attempt, and from that attempt, I went on to write a book. Now, before I proceed, I would like to see whether there are some questions regarding that aspect.
Okay. All right. So we were to do this, and oh, by the way, some people joined the call since we started, so we need to find out who else is here. Who else joined the call once Elias started speaking?
It's Elizabeth Woodworth. Hello, everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Hi.
Welcome, Elizabeth. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
Okay. And well, couldn't hear that. Say it again, please.
It's Marty McGee in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, Martin. Hi, welcome. Okay, Martin McGee. Okay. Anybody else besides Elizabeth and Martin join the call recently? Okay. The way that we'll do this these first rounds, these are just specific questions that can be asked of Elias. And you are limited to no more than 60 seconds to make your question, and then he'll give a response. We'll go on to the next person. We have a speaking order in terms of registration order. And then we'll do another round if there's a need until people feel that their questions have been asked, and then we'll proceed to the next issue that Elias wishes to raise, okay? So let's see, who's first on our list today? I think first one is Barbara Honegger. Go ahead, Barbara, if you have a question.
Hi. Should we hear who just came on, probably?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, hi.
This is who?
This is Sheila.
Oh, hi, Sheila. Okay. Well, we're just about to go through our first round of questions, and this is on the question of the passenger list and lack of evidence or so forth. Okay, so try to keep your questions specific to that issue. Barbara, you're first.
Yes, before I make a comment and ask the question, I'd just like to clarify the rules, if I could, and it sounds to me like Elias has set up a very interesting and I appreciate a kind of format for the call, that he's divided what he has to tell us into sections. So I just wanted to make sure that we will have opportunity to ask our general questions that we were going to.
We've agreed as part of this format that we will reserve at least 30 minutes at the end of the call for more open discussion, okay? So it's probably important to ask Elias to let us know if he gets to the point where he's only got 30 minutes or so left and we haven't gotten there yet to alert us so that we can open it up a little bit. But otherwise, we'll wait until the end of his last segment and then we'll move into the open discussion.
Right. I understand that, but my question was a little different. It sounds like Elias has divided his own presentation to us in sections, and he's asked us to keep our questions to this part, which wasn't going to be my general question. So if he has other parts, can we then go through our whole list for his other parts before the 30 minutes at the end?
Yeah, so that would be my assumption.
Okay, all right.
We'll just go down the list each time and see if anybody has a question, and then move on to the next, okay?
Yeah, for each of his parts. Okay.
Right.
All right. Hi, Elias. This is Barbara Honegger.
Hello, Barbara.
And I'm wonderful to talk to you. I hope that we will be able to have an interaction with you one-on-one by email after this with follow-up. My first comment is, your book is brilliant. Thank you so much for it. I feel that more than anyone else so far on the issue of whether Muslim hijackers carried out the attack, it literally shifts the burden of proof more than anything else to the government. And that's a major breakthrough legally, because I feel personally, I agree with you at the end of your book, that it's time to move directly to a legal process And my general questions later will be for you about some specific questions about that legal process. So that's all I wanted to say at this point. Thank you so much for your book, and it has shifted the burden of proof. And I'll reserve my question about legal venue under international law for later.
Thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Barbara. James Fetzer, you're not here yet, I guess. Paul, do you have a question?
Just a comment. It'll only take my 60 seconds to say that it's a marvelous book you've written, David Elias. And it really fits in well to the fact that when you read the 9/11 Commission report, there's not one shred of evidence that the hijackers did anything. I mean, the alleged hijackers did anything. They assume the conclusion and go on from there. And it's probably the single most important thing in the whole discussion about 9/11 that gets me the most angry. But anyway, your book is marvelous. It's the only book one needs to read to know that there is a cover-up. That's my own opinion. Okay, that's all.
Thank you, Paul. James Shelford?
Well, I'd like to welcome Elias and say that I think his book is just fantastic, the best piece of assembled commentary on evidence that I've seen. And I'd like to ask him if he has yet received any helpful or interesting or promising reviews of it, especially from people who might dispute his findings.
Well, I never received any feedback from people who dispute my findings.
Yes,
sir. I only received positive reviews of people who agreed with my findings.
That's what I was afraid of.
Okay, thanks, James. Lawrence, are you on the call yet? Okay, we'll go to Barry.
Yes, thanks. It's great to be in touch with you again, Elias. I fondly remember what a great host you and your son were when my wife and I visited Iceland and meeting the members of parliament and going to that wonderful place where I was allowed to speak. This is all very fond memories, personally and otherwise. Second thing I'd say is that when I was writing the preface for the book, Elias told me I can't deal with anything personal like that. So I'm doing it here. The third thing would be, sorry? Okay. The third thing would be that I have, in preparation for this, worked out a bit of a thesis, and it would take definitely way over the 15 seconds I have left. So I was sort of asking permission if in the 30 minutes after the end of this part, I'd like to try to present that thesis. And finally, I do have a specific question, and that is which legal bodies, Elias, do you see as most promising for proceeding with attempting to get on the record reliable evidence about 9/11 and hopefully convictions of the perpetrators? So that's a pretty big question, but there it is.
Elias, were you going to deal with that as a separate section?
No, I don't. I can give already the answer. Very simple. The answer is
okay.
No. There is no legal forum where 9/11 can be solved. That's just my opinion. But you can discuss it later.
Okay.
Very interesting.
Thank you. All right, John Spritzer, do you have a question? Let's try to keep this focus as much as we can on the passenger list and the evidence regarding the passengers, okay? And then there will be time later on for general questions. Okay, go ahead, John.
No question. Just I want to say hello to Elias. Nice to hear your voice instead of just keystrokes on the email.
Great.
Okay.
Good.
Good. Martin, do you have a question?
No, nothing at this time. I'll wait till we get to the end. But thank you for the book. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Greg?
Yeah, I have a question. Elias, I'm wondering about getting to the specifics of the evidence or lack of evidence that any hijackers boarded any of the flights. I'm wondering specifically about the video evidence, because we've all seen video of one or more of the alleged hijackers in some airport, and my understanding is that there's no timestamp on this video, even though there normally would be at the location that they're claiming it was. And I've also heard it suggested that this video actually wasn't shot in Boston, but was actually shot in Portland, where Mohammed Atta allegedly first boarded a plane the morning of 9/11 at 6 a.m. or something like that. So I'm wondering if you could comment on the issue of the video evidence, what we know about it, and particularly about whether that footage that we're familiar with seeing actually was from the Portland airport.
Okay, just very briefly, the Portland airport video exists, of course. We don't know really what kind of people, who the people are shown on that video. So we cannot determine, because the images are blurred, who these people are. I mean, the video is not identification. It just suggests that certain people were there. But in any case, it is not a proof that even if the people shown were the Mohammed Atta, who studied in Germany, and this Alomari, who I don't know from where he comes, even if these people were shown on that video, it would not prove that they boarded any aircraft in Boston. So from a legal point of view, it is completely irrelevant what this video shows. But I don't think personally that Mohammed Atta, who studied in Hamburg, had at all gone to the United States. Very probably had a double ganger in America, or even more than one. So we don't really know the identities of the people who were shown on that video. It was shown worldwide in order to give the impression that this is proof of these hijackers. So if there was an intention to deceive by making this video, that's my answer.
Okay, thank you. Barton, do you have a question about this?
No, anything I would have asked has already been asked.
Okay, thanks. Michael Bush?
Yeah, I have a quick question of Elias. I gave a presentation a while back, and we talked about the manifest and how the hijackers didn't show up on the original manifest, and somebody in the audience said, well, they've seen a manifest since then where the hijackers were added. When I went back to check that out, I never found that. It was either taken down again or was never there. But has there ever been a manifest where the hijackers did show up on the manifest?
Yes, there are computer printouts which were released somewhere by the FBI, but in a very underhanded way. It means they did not really authenticate these computer printouts. These computer printouts have been publicized in a book by McDermott in 2006. And they are available in the documentation of the 9/11 Commission, which is stored in the National Archives. But it is not certified, and it's not an authenticated document. It doesn't bear any signature. It is not attributed to any person and to any organization. So basically, I can also make such lists myself at home on my computer. It is not an authenticated document.
Okay, thank you.
And I'd like to mention also that these documents, these lists, were not issued at the Moussaoui trial, but instead the FBI produced graphical layouts of the planes and the seats, which listed the names of the passengers and the alleged hijackers. So the FBI did not consider these computer printouts as sufficiently credible documents.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lars. Sheila? Do you have a question about the passages?
Yeah. Hi, Elias. I regret I have not read your book, so I'm not familiar with your work, although I've heard very good things about it from many people. I'm wondering if you'd be willing to give maybe a two-minute synopsis of what your conclusions were about the passenger lists.
Well, the passenger list, as I said before, they exist no authenticated passenger lists. They don't exist. If I have proposed to journalists, eminent journalists of The Guardian and other media, a prize of more than $10,000 if they can produce any evidence of the 19 hijackers boarding the aircraft. These journalists did not take the challenge. They ran away because they were afraid to be ashamed of writing bullshit about these events. So this offer was on my website for 2 years, and there was no taker. I'm sorry, but I cannot say much more about these passenger lists. They don't.
Oh no, that's fine. That's fine. I'm not asking for anything in particular. I just didn't know, since I'm not familiar with your research. I didn't know if there was something more to it. So the lists that we saw that were printed in the newspaper, do you have any idea where those came from?
I don't know where they came from. I can only guess that a certain passenger lists were made already before 9/11, and they were distributed to the newspapers as proof. And then the problem was that probably something happened and caused the FBI to change the names, some names on the passenger list. So the ultimate passenger list, or the ultimate list of passengers, let's put it this way, was already different than the original one. So there were names which appeared on the 12th of September, for instance, on the Boston Globe website, which were then taken away and replaced by other names. And in my book, I discuss these very peculiar cases.
Okay, thank you. Michael Cook, do you have a question on this?
Not really. I'm familiar with the work. I haven't read the book. Look forward to getting it. And thank you so much, Elias, for your dedication to this. I think it's a very important issue. I really appreciate your $10,000 prize. Nothing to sneeze at. It's very telling that no one has come forward to claim it. Thank you.
Okay. Robin, do you have a question on the passenger list?
Yes, I do. Elias, I'm a former air traffic controller who actually used to work in the Boston Center and in managerial positions to interrelate between the military and FAA operations, and was called upon several times in my career to become involved in investigating incidents, from accidents to just near mid-airs, et cetera. I wanted to share with you one of the points that I go by when I deal with any printed material about anything in an incident from any of the participants, FAA, airlines, whomever. If it's a printed document, what happens after an incident has been called is that all people who may have something to do with that incident, this is my history now, immediately take a look at the written record of their possible involvement, and we have many times caught people modifying and changing their records before they sort of get put forward into a formal report to basically scrub their names and their responsibilities from those documents. And it's all got to do with litigation, losing a job, being proven incompetent.
Robin, I have to interrupt you here because there's a strict 60-second limit on these questions, and you've already gone there. Can you get to your question real quickly for Elias, please?
Yes, Elias. Do you have any evidence that there were people on board who were not seen or called as the hijackers that may have been played a role on board that of taking over the aircraft or anything like that?
I have no evidence of that kind, no.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is
Let's see. I think we're at the end of the list here. Let me double check that. Elizabeth Woodworth, do you have a question on this passenger list?
I don't have a question, Elias, but I just wanted to say hello to you and to say how good it is to meet you on this call and to hear your voice because we've never met. And I got on the call. I'm actually sick today, but I decided I would come on your on this call to congratulate you on your book, which I haven't read. I've read parts of it, but I haven't read it all the way through, and I've seen wonderful reviews. And I'd also like to say that I really agree with the purpose of your book, which is to bring about a cultural revolution based on moral integrity. And I think 9/11 has the potential to do that, and that's why I have been involved in it myself since 2006.
Great, great.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Does anybody else have another question on the passenger list, or can we allow Elias to proceed with his next segment?
This is Barbara. I actually have a question now.
Okay. Go ahead, Barbara.
Yeah, very simply, Elias, could you tell us what would constitute, in your understanding, having done all of this research, what would have constituted what you call an authenticated passenger list at all? In other words, could you define for us the process or what it would look like if you had found an authenticated list?
Yes, I can answer that. An authenticated list would be a list which will, in fact, contain all the names of the passengers signed by a person who could confirm his or her signature in court. It means that the person say, okay, I signed that document, I printed this list from the computer at this and this time. It means a person who could be, and the list would also have followed by a chain of custody report. It means that it was not manipulated on the way. So
right.
Anything of that kind would constitute at least admissible document on which to base. But it will not be sufficient. I will tell you why. Because, first of all, this list, and as I said before, all that kind of documentation would only mean that people who had these names boarded the aircraft. It would not prove that these people committed a crime, and it would not prove the identities of these people, because people can use fake and fraudulent names. So it will give us at least some indication that we have to research more. But even that kind of minimal evidence doesn't exist.
Okay, and then just one quick follow-up, and that is, I take it then that when you, for instance, wrote to the airlines and to the FBI, that you specifically requested an authenticated list, and when they got back to you, did they just not answer, or did they say no? Did they formally say no? There is no authenticated list.
No, this was not the way of the answer. In fact, I put on my website the correspondence with American Airlines, and anybody who will go on my website would be able to read that correspondence. If I remember correctly, I cited this correspondence in my book. What the American Airlines did is to send me first a list, a typed list on an email of the names of the passengers without Arabic names. So when I ask about, I would like to have a complete list, they said, well, this is what we can give you. And when I cite why the Arabic names are not on the list, they were redacted. No explanation why. So that's what American Airlines told me.
Thank you.
This is Mike. If I could ask a question of our air traffic controller real quickly.
Mike, which Mike?
Mike Cook.
Mike Cook, okay. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, it's really great to have an air traffic controller person on here. Thank you for joining us. How strange do you find it that none of the four flights managed to issue a hijacking squawk? Do you consider that to be significant evidence? Thank you.
The answer is yes, I do consider it to be significant evidence, except for I'm also a pilot, and if there was a cockpit incursion and the pilots were being physically dealt with, then one of the last things that would happen would be that they would change the code to hijacking. They would try instead to change it to an in-flight emergency, and neither of those took place. And obviously, presuming if one does presume that the cockpits were breached and somehow they got the pilots out of the seats, etc., I think that the hijackers would certainly not put in a hijacking code. What I do find way more odd is that two radio transmissions talking about, you know, the aircraft being hijacked or stolen, the bombs, because whomever forgot to change this or did not change the little switch that changes from external to internal communications. In my 11 years, there were only three times that I heard a captain mistakenly talk to us in air traffic control with a message that was designed for the cabin. So that's much more unusual for me.
Okay, thank you for that. If you have any other questions for somebody other than Elias, please hold them until the general discussion, okay? Does anybody else have another question for Elias on the question of the passenger list?
Craig,
go ahead.
Craig, I have just a quick follow-up, because one thing I've never really looked into closely that I'm very curious about is the passenger lists that we do have or that have been released, which I understand are not authentic documents, but I'm curious about, in a situation where a flight has had, say, 65, I know one of the flights had 65 passengers, did they release a list that had 65 non-Arabic names that could all be accounted for as passengers, or did they release 60 or 61 and then the other redacted ones would make up the rest? I don't know if that question is clear, but can the alleged hijackers be accounted for in terms of the number of names on the list?
Yes. These computer printouts, which I referred to before, contain all the names, including the names of the alleged hijackers. So we have a complete accounting of the passengers and the hijackers in these computer printouts. But these computer printouts, as I said before, are not authenticated. They are the display, it is not known when they were printed. They were not authenticated by the FBI and so forth.
Right.
I'd like to mention another thing which I discussed also in my book, that for instance, one name on these computer printouts, the name of Ziad Jarrah, the alleged pilot hijacker of United Airlines 93, is written correctly on these computer printouts, whereas in the first days after 9/11, all media reports about him spelled his name with an I at the end, Jarrahi. So there was already one very clear sign of the manipulation. And another sign, as I said before, is the fact that the original lists which were printed by different media, I think CNN and Boston Globe, include, for instance, the name of people who then just disappeared from the later computer printouts and were replaced by other names. So, but these people are still on some websites in the United States listed as victims of 9/11. So this is a very story. It is a story which I discuss in the book, a very strange story, and which also shows that there was some manipulation between the original lists, which were probably prepared before 9/11, and the ultimate lists, which were fixed on about 14th of September.
Okay. If there are no further questions about this issue, then we'll invite Elias to bring up the next issue that he'd like to discuss. Go ahead, Elias. Barbara, is it you again? Well,
one quick question.
Make it really quick, please, because you've already hit
really
twice.
Quick,
go ahead.
Really quick, Elias. Thank you. I'm just curious. I've read your book, and I do not recall. You can correct me if this is incorrect. I do not recall that you mentioned that the Bureau of Transportation Statistics, BTS, database does not show either of the American Airlines flights, 11 or 77, even being scheduled to fly on 9/11, let alone flying on 9/11. And that is very relevant to whether there were any passengers at all, let alone a passenger list. So could you comment on, if I'm correct, why that isn't in the book?
As I remember, I have discussed this BTS case in the book and have tables also discussing these kind of things, but I might have not, I don't remember exactly what I discussed about the BTS, whether I discussed exactly that particular point you raised. So I cannot offhand say it. I will have to look it into the book.
Right, so, yes, of course, you have those BTS tables, but I don't recall that you connected the fact that Flight 11 and 77 weren't scheduled to fly and apparently didn't fly according to the BTS records to the question of passenger lists for either Flight 11 and 77. So if you didn't, that would be something to add in the future.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. That's it.
Okay. Great. All right. Elias, would you like to bring up the next issue then?
Yes. I would like to discuss another aspect of 9/11, which also has been relatively little investigated, and it is the genesis of the 9/11 narrative or 9/11 story. Many people have, of course, noted the speed by which the FBI went to Florida to check on the flight school and bars and so on.
Hold on, Elias. Is any our others experiencing?
There's background noise.
Yeah, there's a lot of background noise. It's just stopped. Whoever stopped it, thank you. Continue, please, Elias. We weren't able to hear very much of what you said because of that background noise, so maybe you could just repeat a little bit.
Yes. I noticed that few people have been studying the genesis or the birth of the 9/11 narrative. So I went to try out to find at which point the facts of 9/11 were put in the world. I'm talking about the facts, the actual facts. Of course, speculation is one thing, but when I discovered that the U.S. Congress determined the facts of 9/11 24 hours after the events, and the Security Council of the United Nations determined on the 12th of September, 12 noon, that this was a case of international terrorism, whereas at that point in time, there were no evidence that there was an international dimension to the attacks, because these were flights in domestic flights in the United States. So there was no evidence of any international aspect or dimension to the attacks. Yet the Security Council, which doesn't usually make decisions very very lightly, determined 24 hours later that it was an act of international terrorism, and even hinted that the United States the right to...
Excuse me, Elias. If somebody has background conversation going on, please press star 6 and it will mute your phone and you can press star 6 to come back, okay? Star 6 if you have background conversation. I'm sorry, Elias. Please continue.
Yeah. So these facts raised the red light for me. I said, well, how can a political institution decide in 24 hours how this operation was conducted? There was no investigation yet. Nobody really knew what was happening. And I went on to the debates in the U.S. Congress, which took place on the 12th of September. I read all these debates. And I discovered that one of the congressmen who presented the resolution of the Congress said that the resolution had been already in preparation on the very day of 9/11. Now, the resolution, and there would be, of course, absolutely legitimate for the Congress to make a resolution, condemn the attacks, and express solidarity with the victims, and demand an investigation, and so forth. And that has been done by many, many organizations. But what was very particular about this resolution is that it contained factual determination. So, including the fact that it was an attack from outside the United States, it was determined that the crashes of the aircraft caused the demise or the collapse of the buildings, and he talked about hijackings. Now, all these factual statements could not be known to the Congress members at that time because the issue had not been investigated yet. And what is interesting about that, and this is politically interesting, not from a forensic point of view, is that no Congress member asked for evidence for these factual statements. There was a complete consensus, a complete acclamation of all these facts, and people aligned themselves behind the president, behind these facts, with no questions asked. And the same thing applied to the Security Council, in which we have China, Russia, Britain, France, and other countries sitting there, asking no questions either. This, for me, is a very important point, politically very important, which transcends the interests of the United States. It goes into the international order and has some bearing on the decision to proceed with the war on terror, which is supported by most countries. So we have here a completely different different dimension of 9/11 that transcends very much the American situation, and therefore I am tending to believe that the decision has been taken internationally with the cooperation of other countries, that to set out with a war on terror, which is very useful for many governments. But this is an issue which has to be discussed separately from today. So this was, I wanted to say these things in order to draw attention to the speed in which the facts were determined by political institutions. And this is discussed in my book in great detail. And the third part I'd like to discuss here, probably in your group, is that all these findings led me to wonder how to interpret the phone calls made from the aircraft. Because if there were no Muslim hijackers, how do we explain the fact that people called for the aircraft and told their next of kin that they were hijacked, that some of the hijackers looked Middle Eastern, and so forth. So I decided to embark upon a very thorough investigation of all the phone calls on which I could find information. and I found that there were 57 phone calls on which there is information, mostly from 9/11 to the United Nations 93, but also quite a few from the others, and went on to investigate all these phone calls, going to every to the possibility of finding information. So I based myself on interviews made by the FBI with recipients of the telephone calls, interviews by media with the recipients, books written by some of the recipients, and every other source which I could find, which would throw some light on the contents of these phone calls. And this research comprises about half of the book. It is extremely detailed. And it is we have no time here to go over that research. But what I'd like to do is to just to summarize the conclusion of that research, because these conclusions are very important. So the question, as I said before, was to what could we make out of these calls? And my conclusion is that the callers, I don't know whether they called from the aircraft or from the ground, this issue I leave out of my book. What is more important is that these callers did not describe real events. They described, in fact, they were telling stories. They were telling fairy tales. They were telling. They were, in fact, telling their families what they were told to say. They were not telling what they were observing. So this means that they were acting. Now, the question is, on which base would these people act? This is the only plausible conclusion I could find, that these people were, in fact, acting. They were not telling real events. And then I remembered that there were exercises on 9/11 about simulated hijackings. And if I would run a simulated hijacking, I would look for people who would play the role of passengers and do it realistically. So I would take people and say to them, look, we are doing an exercise, a counter-terrorism exercise. Would you accept to participate in it? It is a patriotic honor and a patriotic duty to do that. And many people would accept to do that. And they would be told that their only role would be to call their families or some people, tell them that they were hijacked and so forth and so on. And those who did not want to deceive their own families were given the choice of calling the airlines or some security people or whoever it was. And so we had, from that on, people would accept to do it, and that's how the calls were organized. This is my conclusion. I cannot prove this conclusion, but I find it the most plausible explanation for these calls. Now, I think I would now stop this section and I think that probably some questions will be welcome now.
Okay, thank you very much, Elias. Barbara, you're first again.
Okay, hi Elias, this is Barbara. Just a quick comment and then a question. I presume that when you were saying earlier in this segment that the Congress and the United Nations resolutions were very quick the next day to state the facts. By that, you meant the alleged facts. You meant the so-called facts of the official story. So I'm assuming you can answer. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. Of course.
Yeah. Okay. You used the word facts, so I was just curious. Okay, so my comment is I agree with you. I was very, very early getting out, as you know, the information on the war games and the fact that there had to be at least one, and now we know more than one, hijacked scenario exercise on the morning of 9/11. Mike Rupert, credits me for the origin of that in his book, Crossing the Rubicon. So I was doing that back in August of 2002, and even then I believed that almost everything could be explained in terms of the exercises and preparations for them. And so I completely agree with you with your conclusion about that. So it's wonderful that you've put that into the public domain so clearly, so I appreciate that. And I think that that is my comment then. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. James, let's see, James Fetzer, you're not with us yet, are you? Paul?
Yes. Hello?
Paul, go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to, this is kind of a question, but it's more an observation. When Elias's book came out, he got about five-star reviews on Amazon and one-star review. The one-star review said that you have greatly distorted the evidence of the phone calls. And the person, and so some people objected very clearly to this woman, who then said that she was Glick's wife. And so one other person asked her to elaborate. I asked her to elaborate on Amazon.com, and then Elias asked her to elaborate. And within 1 week, the whole thread was deleted. Now, what's interesting about it is that Elias actually took the actual official evidence about these phone calls and not anything else. So therefore, if she had elaborated, she would have had to elaborate of how the FBI had distorted the evidence. So Elias, maybe you want to comment. I mean, I know you know that story, but you might want to comment on how important you think that is.
I couldn't hear. Maybe others couldn't. Whose wife?
Glick's wife. Glick.
Who?
Jeremy Glick.
Oh, yes. Jeremy Glick. Thank you.
She has a new name, however, but I have this. I kept a record of it, so I have I have the record.
Great.
Well, I would not like to comment on it because I don't think it is very. It is of profound interest. It is probably the. I suspect that the person who wrote that was an authentic person, and she probably got a little frightened. I don't know really, but I don't consider that as a very important issue.
Okay. Thank you, Elias. Let's see. James Huffer, do you have a question on this issue?
Well, yes. Well, more of a comment, really. Well, a couple of comments. First of all, what convinced me to begin with was the fact that that all of the alleged, well, the core of the alleged facts were all stated in the news media on 9/11 itself before the end of the day, and I knew that that was impossible because there wasn't time for an investigation to come up with the names and pictures and all that stuff. Then I'd like to say that I don't think that it would have been necessary for the actual alleged passengers on the planes to have been even involved in making phone calls to their relatives because with voice morphing technology, you or I could do the speaking and it would be morphed into the voice of whoever you wanted it to be. So I think if they just had samples of their voices ahead of time, that they wouldn't have had to been present themselves at all anywhere to make those calls.
Okay.
I suppose that it is a question to me.
Well,
yeah,
well, yes. I mean, am I incorrect about that?
Well, I deal with theory in the book, and I tend to reject that theory because of the risk entailed. I believe that it was not voice morphing. I know this theory has been propounded particularly by our friend David Ray Griffin. Mm-hmm. And we are good, very good friends, and I don't want to put him in bad light. But I don't agree with this conclusion, because I believe that this is extremely risky, particularly when you are calling your family members. And if you are making mistakes in names of children or terms of endearment or whatever, then people will become suspicious. And I think that this is not... I cannot really accept that this was possible. I have never seen any case, at least any evidence, that it is possible to deceive one's family with such morphing. I know that if you are, you can of course morph, say Saddam Hussein or some other president's speech or some of Bin Laden. But if you have an interactive dialogue with somebody who you know very well, and the person knows you very well, such method is, I find, extremely risky. And therefore, I don't tend... But if that method, if there is any evidence for that, I would accept it, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mike mm-hmm. Cook.
Okay.
Certainly.
All right. Let's see. Thank you. The next person on the list is Barry.
Yes. Elias, I have read your book, of course, and I have it here, but I forget, and also can't find in the index, a reference to cell phones, specifically vis-a-vis the matter of cell phones on aircraft, not talking about air phones, talking about cell phones, at that time in 2001, and the research of Kay Dewdney here in Canada, using actual aircraft, actual cell phones, and so forth, showing it above a certain altitude, and it's really around 2,000 or 3,000 feet, it was impossible then to have any transmission at all, whether it was morphed or whatever. And so I'd ask you to remind me whether you dealt with that aspect of the fraud, and if not, what do you think about it nevertheless?
I did in some in the book. I did deal with this question. Of course, I did. And in fact, yes, I did. And in fact, it is particularly important regarding the calls to Dina Burnett from her husband Thomas Burnett in United Airlines 93, because she very much made a point that she received cell phone calls. She saw the number of the telephone on her own telephone, and she repeated it to the FBI, and the FBI did not want to believe her. So there was a contradiction between her testimony and what the FBI said. And Dina did not really suspect the government of any malfeasance. No, she just wanted to stick to what she saw. And what she saw and what she said, she repeated in her own book. She repeated on the website of the Burnett Foundation. So she stuck to her own perceptions, to her own eyewitness, which is very an act of courage, I find. And this shows that the story of the cell phone, this shows that, first of all, the official story is wrong. And secondly, that it is very, very likely that her husband did not call her from the aircraft. That's why I say that I don't know whether the calls were made from an aircraft, or from an aircraft flying low, or from the ground. This is a thing which we don't know.
Okay, thank you. Let's see. Next is John Spritzler. Do you have a question on this, John?
No, I don't.
Thank you. Martin McGee?
No, nothing at this point.
Thank you, Martin. Craig? Craig McKee? Star 6, if you're muted, Craig.
Sorry, I'm back. I had muted myself, sorry. My question is on the issue of cell phone calls versus air phone calls. I'm wondering if you could address the issue of calls that were originally listed as cell phone calls that later were listed as air phone calls, and whether any of those calls came from planes that could not have had air phones, whether there's any proof that some of the flights didn't have air phones.
I did not address this issue. I found the issue of cell phone calls versus air phone calls a side issue from the in my own attempt to understand the reason for the phone calls. So what I tried to do is to find out what these phone calls meant. And I did not really go into depth whether it was a cell phone or an air phone. I am quite aware of this discussion, but I find it not, it isn't basically a discussion or a debate which is already dépassé, which is already, we went further than that. It is not really important at this point, in my opinion. It is clear that the entire story about phone calls is such a deception, such a lie, that it is really not the most important thing to know whether this call was done with a cell phone or with the air phone. But this is, of course, this is my opinion after having done this research. So take it from that.
Okay.
Thanks. This is Ken Freeland. My name is next on the list, so I'm going to make a quick comment here. I'm quite taken with Elias's speculation about the acting on behalf of a drill scenario, because I happen to think that that's also the most plausible explanation for Sandy Hook, for which there was another parallel, which is the complete destruction of the building so that there could not be any forensic examination of its content. So just wanted to mention that in passing. Barton, Bruce, do you have a question for Elias?
Not really. Just a quick comment on what you just said is that would also account the Muslims at the London bombing.
Point taken.
They were asked to participate in a drill, and
right.
That's what they get trapped in. That's why the guy was panicking when he realized what must be in his backpack.
Yeah. Good point.
Well, the London event, I don't want to discuss them now. There is a hypothesis that these four people were participating in the drill. I don't know whether this hypothesis is correct or not. It might be correct. It is plausible, at least. But I don't want to go into that now.
Right. Okay. Michael Booth?
I'll pass. Thank you.
Oh, you pass. Okay, thank you. Sheila?
Yeah, hi. Just a comment, Elias. I agree with you about the voice morphing. As much as I applaud the work of David Ray Griffin, and he was really the one who woke me up back in 07. I read his book, A New Pearl Harbor, in 48 hours, and I knew, and that was it. I went from knowing nothing to being full-on MIHOP in 48 hours. But I do agree with you that there would just not be possible to fake that with a family member. There's too much that could go wrong, you know, not knowing the name of a pet or something important about a family member. So I can't see that it could be voice morphing. But I also don't think that they would do it willingly, because it's just too much to put a family member through. I mean, think about the horror of having someone leave on a flight and then getting a call that they're on a hijacked flight. You would be absolutely in a state of panic. So I think that they had guns held to their heads, and I can't see how they would do it under any other circumstances. And I I think that if
you're out of minutes, Sheila.
Okay, that's it. Bye bye.
Thanks. Thank you. You want to comment on it, Elias, or no?
Well, I will make a mental note of your comment, Sheila. I'm very appreciated that you said that. I did not really think about this aspect, but we should at least keep it in mind. I believe that at least some of these people were surely not coerced. I mean, I'm mentioning first the call by Betty Ong to the reservation center of the American Airlines. She was talking for 25 minutes. I don't believe that somebody was with a gun on her head, and I don't believe that that at least some of these calls did not seem to me from the content to be done under coercion. But I might be wrong. I would keep it at least back in my mind. Thank you very much, Sheila.
Okay, thank you. Michael Cook, do you have a question?
Yeah, a couple of statements. I think it's unfortunate, Elias, that you're not aware of the evidence for the call morphing technology. It's abundant. There was major publications that covered it. Colin Powell did a demonstration with it, and that's famously been covered. I think that it is the most likely explanation for the phone calls. They could not have been done from the air. That's been established. And I don't think you should count on these people to do things that always make a lot of sense. You say it would be too risky, but, I mean, this pretty psychopathic behavior that they're doing. And there's been a lot of little items that have popped up where they really screwed up. You know, Muhammad Atta's will was supposed to be in his luggage that was going to be on the plane and be destroyed with him. And why would he? That would be a funny place to put the will. The car at the airport that he was supposed to have driven or flown into. So why would he have a rental car there if he was flying into there and that sort of thing? It's definitely the most plausible explanation is that they were voice morphed. And the purpose is just to instigate the official story and the heroic let's roll aspect of the Flight 92, which was meant to encourage military enlistment, I think. You know, we gotta go get these guys, that kind of thing. Thank you.
Okay. You want to comment on that, Elias?
I just wanted to ask you, have you read my book?
No, I have not read your book. I've heard interviews with you and on the radio, with Kevin Barrett's show and other places, I think. And I do look forward to reading the book.
After reading my book, I would like to have you write me an email after you read my book about this.
Okay, sure. Happy to. Yeah, I'm very very proud or very fond of your work. I think you've done a great job. This is just an aspect that I think you may be missing the boat. It's no huge deal, and it doesn't detract from all the other great work you've done.
No, I understand. I don't take it this way. I just would like you to write to me so we can exchange.
Sure thing, we'll do.
Okay.
Okay.
Robin Horton, do you have a question on this on these issues?
Yes, I do, Elias. The basic question is, how aware are you of the compartmentalization that is involved? Actually, it is a requirement for war games exercises. I'm the air traffic controller again, and I claim that the entire event of 9/11, okay, I call it the 9/11 attacks war game scenario, in which every single element that we are talking about here could be a compartmentalized action with the participants not really knowing what's going on. War games are very virtual, and radar techs, anybody can be doing anything anywhere at any time and have it be scripted to not look like it had events going on in the Northeast. it could have been anywhere, any part of the country. And the radar techs are just doing their war game exercise, or other participants are just doing what they've been doing for 30, 40 years. You know about compartmentalization and how specific that is.
Well, I am quite aware of the concept itself, but I have never engaged in any kind of activity which is engineering to it. So I'm very happy to learn more about it.
Well, I have a little bit, and I'll just say to you that as an air traffic controller, my role in pulling off and engaging in war games is to get the military assets to and from particular places. And when I contacted the war games people, the military, in the old fashion, it was called Air Defense Command, I had to make sure specifically that I only talked to one particular sector in NORAD or Air Defense Command at that time, because if I opened my mouth or contacted the wrong person, all of a sudden the integrity of the war games would be compromised. And so to me, it's very easy how Cheney could be sitting in the PEOC, and fundamentally him being one of the few people that know all of the compartments involved in what was needed to go on 9/11, and to just either steer him or help steer him or approve or disapprove or whatever. So for anybody to understand how all of these things could go on, just really looking into how war games work is very, very fascinating.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, do you have a question on this?
Yes, I do. Elias, you mentioned about the resolution in Congress soon after the event, and I didn't get whether that was the 11th or the 12th of September, but I wondered, what time of day and when exactly did they pass that resolution?
Well, they began to debate it at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I think it was passed around 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
On the 11th or on the 12th?
On the 12th.
Okay. The 12th. Because if you haven't looked in the congressional record, you probably have, knowing how well you research things, but you can pin these things down and find out, exactly how early, because it's very important to know how much time they had to prepare that.
Yes.
And the other thing...
You can find it in my book.
Okay. Did you quote the congressional record?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, fine. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is that I think it's very interesting, your idea that the simulated hijackings would probably happen in relation to actors, or could very likely have done. And... I just recently heard about these crisis actors that they've been using in places like Boston and Los Angeles. And somebody told me, a woman I know in Paris, that these actors, there are actually instructions from FEMA on how these actors are to proceed with their work. And apparently this is available on the Internet, but I haven't seen it yet. But if that's happening now with all these things that are looking like false flag operations, I don't know how many of you have been following some of the research that's being done online now, but it could well have started back on 9/11 with the use of, in quotes, crisis actors to be working in tandem with those simulated hijackings. So that's just a comment. I wonder what you might say about that.
Well, this is something I'm not aware of, but I'm sure that some people have been scripted. I'm not talking about the callers. Maybe some of the callers, yes, but not all of them. There were some people, I'm sure, have been scripted and coached what to tell to the media and so on and so forth. But I really don't know what I should say about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, has anybody joined the call recently that we didn't have on the list that wasn't here earlier?
Yeah, this is Mike Booth. Can I ask a quick question after I passed?
I'm sorry, who is this?
This is Mike Booth again. I passed before.
Yeah, you can go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
The in the film, the new Pearl Harbor, the 5.5-hour documentary, there's a section in there on the phone calls where at the end of one of the phone calls, when the female person says goodbye to her, I think it was her husband or her boyfriend, you can hear her whisper, and this is emphasized, it's a hoax or something like that. Has there been any other research done on that particular little segment?
This is Ken. What she actually is supposed to have said is it's a frame. Okay.
It's a frame, yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Elias.
Well, I did not do a research on that. Some of our friends who are, I think some of you probably did some research. I don't remember who did this research, tried to analyze what was saying, what she, it was C.C. Lyles on the United Airlines 93 who supposedly said it's a frame. And somebody tried to analyze it through some software, and it appears that she said something like that, but I could not really make it out. I mean, it is very, very blurred, I mean, the sound of it. But it could be.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Does anybody have another that's spoken once already want to ask another question on this issue, or should we move on?
I have a follow-up. It's Barbara.
Oh. Barbara, go ahead.
Yeah, Elias. Thank you so much again. It's a general question, a very big question, and it's completely related to this topic. You know, you haven't raised it separately, and you may want, what I'm looking for is a general comment from you, really, and that is that, do you have any reason to believe, seeing as I agree with you, that the evidence is that if these phone calls were real phone calls at all, that they had to have taken place either on the ground or close to the ground or perhaps not even in an airplane? If these calls were either part of an exercise, or if the participants, the alleged passengers, had participated in an exercise and made these pretend calls earlier than 9/11, that would give the CIA or whatever agency the sufficient amount of audio recording to do voice morphing later on 9/11. So it might be that both are true in some hybrid kind of way. But my general question is, do you have any reason to believe, or have you done any research on, seeing as these passengers have presumably died and have not been heard from, the big question of, so what happened to the passengers? Do you have any reason to believe that they are actually dead, number one? And two, do you have any reason to believe that their family members who receive these calls could be part of the fraud?
Well, I would like to answer, I cannot prove anything of that kind, but on the preponderance of the evidence, I believe, first of all, that all these passengers died, because I have come across many websites where people are mourning these passengers, some church services held for these people, and foundations made on their names, and so forth. Secondly, I don't believe that the families would play around with the death of their next of kin and act as if their next of kin were dying and they would not die. This would it would be extremely risky if these people were not dead, because if they would appear anywhere known by others alive, it will completely destroy the entire system. So I don't believe that they are alive, first of all. Secondly, I don't believe that their families have been involved in this scam. Very probably, and this is my guess, is that these people who were asked to participate were asked because they were trusted by some authority that they will be able to do that. It was not just anybody. They were people who were trusted to do that kind of, to play that kind of role and to keep quiet about it. This is my general feeling, but I'm open to any other hypothesis.
Well, yes, just one sentence of follow-up. I agree with you on all that. But what that means is, if you stick to, as I agree with you, if you stick to your hypothesis that the preponderance of evidence would be that these phone calls were part of an exercise that could have even been recorded before 9/11, what that means is that authorities have killed, independently perhaps of 9/11, a very large number of people.
Mike Cook?
I didn't get the question.
Could you repeat that, Barbara, in a nutshell, so that Elias can respond to that?
Oh, I'm sorry, Elias. Did you say you didn't hear?
I didn't hear. What was the question?
Oh, the question is, well, it was a comment in the form of a question, I guess, or vice versa. If you are correct, and I agree that you probably are, it's been my own hypothesis that the phone calls, or most of the phone calls that are attributed to 9/11, were done in the context of the individuals making the calls believing that they were part of an exercise. Now, that could have been done before 9/11 or on 9/11, either one. But if you are correct about that, and I think you are, that means that the authorities have murdered a large number of people, the so-called passengers. So if they didn't
fail
planes, how do you think they died?
I don't know how they died. The United States government is a criminal organization. So because it is engaging in wars of aggression where thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are dying. It has also killed in history, or tried to kill its own citizens, for instance, in the attack on the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, which was basically a project initiated by the Pentagon and helped by Israel. So, and they decided to sacrifice the crew of the USS Liberty for some strategic purpose of the Pentagon or the United States. So the United States government is not doesn't have very much problems of murdering its own citizens if it serves a strategical need. So I don't have a problem with that. How they were killed is a question which I cannot answer.
Okay, that seems like a fair answer. Does anybody else have a follow-up question?
Mike?
Lorenzo's on the call now.
Who is?
Lorenzo called in about 5 minutes ago. That's me.
Okay, Lorenzo, we'll put you on the list. Go ahead, Mike Cook.
Hey, thanks a lot. A couple quick points. One, I should correct myself. There's no reason to believe that there could not be some voice-morphed calls and some calls that were coerced or done as part of a drill. Certainly, if that lady said it's a frame, then that indicates a coerced call. And as far as what happened to the passengers, you know, it's total speculation. But if you look at the history, the government has often sought out subjects for experiments, like the MK Ultra mind control experiments and stuff. Those people could still be alive in some lab somewhere functioning as a lab rat, or they could have been killed and disposed of in any number of ways. There's really no way to know for sure. But that's, I think that they, you know, I know that they go after subjects like that for these scientific Joseph Mengele-type experiments that they do, that they've been caught doing, that they've admitted to, and you know, live passengers would be kind of a valuable resource for them. Why would you necessarily want to destroy this good material that you could use to advance your agenda? Thank you.
Okay. Lorenzo, you're late on the call, but do you have any questions of Elias about the passenger list or anything relating to that?
About the only question or comment that I have is that there's been a lot of individuals making allegations that neither of those flights had actually been manifest. Another comment would be that there's a possibility that a number of the, if there were manifest flights and they did fly and there were passengers dealt with, some of them may have been complicit and some of them may have just, been mixed up in the fray and disposed of in whichever way. Again, it's also speculative. I very rarely go into areas like this.
Okay. All right. Elias, do you have a comment? Yeah.
No, I just wanted to make a comment about the morphing issue just for a moment, and that is that there's another problem with morphing, and that is the people we think might have been morphed are often the people who are late passengers on the plane, I mean, are late attendants on the plane, and therefore there wasn't the opportunity to get images of their voice in order to be able to morph them. That's all.
Okay. All right. Elias, do you have another topic that you want to deal with, or was that it?
I would like just to terminate with some words which are more political in nature, because I am working now on other topics, and if you can give me a couple of minutes to terminate my contribution.
Mm-hmm. Feel free.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I'd like to say that for me, 9/11 is a closed chapter. Of course, we don't know all the details. For me, it is a crime committed by the United States government, very probably through the Pentagon and its different agencies. For me, that the details of how they did it exactly is not anymore so important. What is important is to rally the American public and particularly for the 9/11 truth movement to try to engage those parts of the U.S. population which is concerned about democratic rights, about constitutional rights, about peace and so on, and to try to increase that kind of movement, to engage with that movement in order to restore the democratic nature of the United States. Worldwide, we have the same problem. We have governments which are engaging in false flag operations. We have that the UK government in 7th of July 2005, where the Spanish government, we have the government of India who does it regularly. We have the government of Pakistan who does it regularly. Jordan, Turkey, Philippines, Indonesia, wherever you go, you have that kind of phenomenon used as a form of governance in order to rally the public behind the government and to prevent social movements to destroy and not to destroy social movements to reach democratic rule and the social rights. So basically, we have that problem all over worldwide. And so I'm now working on a book regarding the events of Mumbai in India 2008, which was very complex, probably more complex than 9/11. And so what we are up to is an imperialist system led by the United States with its own allies, with NATO allies, and we must take 9/11 out from the forensics into the realm of politics, of political struggle for democracy, for human rights, for peace. And I think this is very important because we now possess a great deal of evidence. We will never reach that the level of evidence which would allow us to bring Mr. So-and-so into court. And anyhow, no court will accept to do it unless there will be a regime change in the United States. So unless there will be a revolution in the United States, no single judge will dare to bring a real court issue against the U.S. government and all these people. The same thing applies to media, to universities, and so on. And the same thing applies in the international scale. I don't believe that the General Assembly of the United Nations will dare to bring to establish an international commission of inquiry, because most countries will be afraid to do that in order not to offend the United States. So we are up to our challenge is basically to bring the issue of 9/11 into the large political struggle. This is my opinion. Thank you. I'd like if you would like to make comments, it's fine. But I think that I'm just I'm through now. Thank you.
Thank you, Elias. I think with that, we could go ahead and enter into our more open-ended discussion, and we'll do that by allowing people to list themselves on the stack to make comments about anything relating to anything Elias has said, or more general questions about the 9/11 issue and the political implications. So who would like to be on the stack?
I would like to speak. Elizabeth here.
Barbara, we go through our stack on this issue that he just mentioned?
Well, no, because I take it that Elias, you want to close the call out at this point, or not?
Well,
this is a very important topic.
Elias, did I understand from your comments that you would like to bring the call to a conclusion at this point, or not particularly?
No, I'm not bringing the call to a conclusion. I just said that my contribution, my special contribution, has closed. I would continue to participate like anybody else.
Right. Okay. Well, it seems to me that we should open, because we said we would reserve 30 minutes at least to more open-ended discussion. And since Elias has kind of opened the discussion at this point, I think we should move into that part, because that is what we agreed to do. So I would like to go ahead and...
What about, Ken, what if, as an alternative, those of us who want to ask questions specifically on what he just said could do that first, so that we'll be on topic, and then open it up?
Well, that would be a question of how much time Elias would like to continue to devote to the call. Would you like to do it that way, Elias, or let people comment on this particular issue and then do an open-ended comment, or would you like to move into the open-ended comment now?
I leave it to you.
Open-ended.
Well, let's take a voice vote here. How many would like to continue this in the format that we have, and to just address this one question and then to move into open-end discussion versus opening it up now? So all in favor of continuing the format and dealing with this particular issue and then having an open-end discussion, say aye.
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 All who would prefer to move into the open-ended part now, say aye.
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 Okay, I think the first group has it, so we'll go ahead and continue our format on this particular question using our existing speaking order. Barbara, you're first.
Oh, okay, Elias. Yes, a comment and then a question. I personally do not want to believe, and don't believe, that it is impossible to achieve legal justice for 9/11. I have to believe in my heart and soul that we can, and I think that we need to try more. And my question to you is, I read that last section of your book, I read your whole book, but the last section of your book, where you basically say what you did on the call, that you don't think that it's possible. Apparently what you're saying is that you don't think the political will is there, either at any international level or in the United States. Because if that's what you mean, I think you need to say that. Because at the end of your book, you do say that international law requires nations to investigate any enforced disappeared persons, which the passengers are. So my question to you is, why do you mean that you just believe there's not the political will because you yourself put forward the legal international law basis for moving forward at the end of your book? Thank you.
Well, the answer is very simple. Legal norms which have been established and by the international community and some of the human rights norms which I'm referring to, states are not basically interested in pursuing and enforcing these norms when their interests clash with these norms. We are talking about norms which exist, which we can invoke, but the balance of forces in the international order is precluding the enforcement of these norms because many states have a vested interest in engaging in false flag operations. And while Russia and China and United States and Britain and its allies all are very interested in being able to carry out false flag operations, they would surely not venture and try to enforce these rules. So that's what I'm meaning. But the legal norms exist. It's true.
Thank you,
so
Elias.
Barbara, let's move on.
No, Barbara, I'll come back to you, but we have to keep this to a minute. That's what our current format is, okay?
Okay,
you already used that. Okay. Paul, you're next.
Yeah, I had a question about the international dimension that you've just touched upon a little bit. Does your evidence suggest kind of the weight of the United States versus, let's say, France and Israel or the United Kingdom with regard to 9/11? I mean, that's beyond what you were talking about, but it's connected to this international dimension you were just mentioning.
Well, I am rather agnostic about the participation of other countries in 9/11, like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, the UK. I suspect that some of these countries have been complicit or assisting in some way, but I don't have any hard evidence on that. We have soft evidence pointing to these countries, but I am absolutely confident that the central, the decision to do that and the coordination was in the Pentagon. I don't believe that any other countries would do it within the United States on the back of the U.S. military. It is impossible.
Okay. James Hufford?
I have nothing to say right now.
Thank you, James. Barry?
Yeah, this is great. I really do agree, and I have actually, I guess all my life, I've been an internationalist, and I'm an old-fashioned believer in world government, but I realize all the dangers that go with that, but they're great dangers if we just have international anarchy continuing, which we're seeing. So I'm very much with Elias on that. I'd like to, at the same time, pick up on what Elias just said, where he mentioned that there would be some other countries, possibly Israel, Saudi Arabia, for instance, who had some involvement in 9/11, but that it was masterminded essentially out of the Pentagon, and I would say its contractors. And I also agree with that. But let's, for a moment, if we may, just link this back to the previous special telecon with Christopher Berlin. And I asked myself, what are the most important aspects of 9/11? And I agree with Elias almost entirely, but not entirely, that the details of 9/11 in a way are past us, and we must move toward education, international education, political movements, grassroots movements, and so on. I agree with that. However, when it comes to the details of 9/11, there is this one really important detail that Christopher emphasized, which is the role of Israel. And so when I ask myself what are the most important aspects of 9/11, arguably you could say, for instance, and this allies itself with Elias's approach, that it doesn't matter the exact nature of the explosive material or materials or the sources of energy used to execute these engineered destructions. Well, we don't need to really think about that. However, we do know that these resources had to be on the level that only states possess. Now, only two states, as far as I could make out, could be seriously involved, and that would be the USA and Israel. I mean, obviously, Saudi Arabia was involved, but not really any believable evidence that, for instance, even the UK, let alone Russia or China, has been involved. And then when we look at some other details, which again would lead us, they may be details, but they would lead us back to, I hope, like a sort of theory. You had Lucky Larry Silverstein.
Excuse me, I have to interrupt here. If somebody has a dog barking in the background or something like that, please press star 6, and the rest of us won't have to hear that. Thank you. And then you press star 6, and it will bring back when you're needing to speak. And I have to remind you, Barry, that we're trying to limit this to about a minute. Okay, go ahead.
Sure, agreed. And I was hearing that sound, too, and I'm still hearing it. So somebody needs to press star 6, please.
Star 6, please.
But anyway, just quickly, super quickly, just glancing over details, Lucky Larry Silverstein, the high-fiving Israelis, they did exist. Dov Zakheim did exist, was in a central perch with Pentagon finances and remote control. And the ferocity of the disruptive activities of these numerous state agents, inauthentic truthers, and I'm not even going to name names here, that we all know, shows that at the highest levels of the diabolicarchy, they're very, very sensitive about the Pentagon. Now, simplistically speaking, there would be three positions. One is Israel did it. Another is Israel had nothing to do with it. Obviously, the third position is the only tenable one, Israeli involvement to one extent or another. Now, why is this important? Why does it relate back to what Elias is encouraging, and I agree with us, to be internationally involved in education and political movements? It's because with Israel and its intransigent attitude toward Iran and the false flag operation just seen in Syria, Israel could arguably be instrumental in setting ablaze World War III. And so I think that we have to, I'm in my own work, because I'm not suggesting this and I'm coming to a conclusion, for everybody. I mean, one size does not fit all when we ask the question, what should we do? So the question for me personally is to keep working on my book about false flag operations, but pay a lot more attention to Israeli false flag in operations and whatever involvement Israel had in 9/11, because we're looking at the precipice here, and I fear that there are psychopaths at the top who would be willing to tip us into World War III, just as there were, 50 years or back 100 years ago with the start of World War I.
Okay, you want to comment on that, Elias, or respond to that?
No, I would not like to comment on it. I would leave, because it will go on. It would require quite a lot of discussion, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can bring that back up when we get to the general discussion, and maybe that, because I think it's a point that a number of people would like to have further discussed. So we'll postpone that if that's okay with you, Barry.
Oh, sure.
Okay. John Spritzer, do you have a question or something to say on this issue?
Tell me exactly what is the issue.
Well, the question of the larger political dynamic of 9/11, I guess, and where we go.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, go ahead.
A comment?
Yeah.
Okay. Elias, I think, said absolutely correctly, in my opinion, that this isn't, that the powers that be in the world are not going to let a legal investigation take place that will expose the false flag nature of 9/11. The objection to Elias's statement seems to be one of the driven by despair at what that means, because it means that the only way to solve the problem that we confront is with, as Elias used the word, revolution, regime change, revolution in the United States, which I think is true. But a lot of people think that that's impossible. And I would just like to say that if you Google something that I co-authored, just Google the phrase "thinking about revolution" with spaces between the words, you'll see a 30-page document that I co-authored, which discusses why revolution in the United States is indeed quite possible, and we should be thinking in terms of it. Thank you.
Okay. Craig. Star Search, Craig. Craig, are you with us? Well, let's go on to Barton, and then if Craig comes back, we can give him a chance. Go ahead, Barton, if you have anything to say.
I was on mute. No, I have nothing for this part. I'm eagerly waiting for the general.
Okay. Let me think. Who's next on the list here? Craig, are you back yet? Ooh, we lost our secretary. Okay. Let's see. After Barton is Michael Bluth. Michael, do you have anything you want to add? Star 6 if you're muted, Michael. Okay, Sheila?
Yeah, hi. I think I agree with Elias that there is, without a revolution, there is no way to have a what they call new investigation into 9/11. And I actually think a great deal of harm is done by pretending that it's possible to have a new investigation. This is one of my quibbles with A&E, because that's what they're always doing, is saying we're asking for a new investigation. And it seems to me that that is turning a blind eye to the abundant amount of evidence that exists that we no longer have really a functioning republic, and that's not going to happen. And I find when I bring up a lot of issues around the Pentagon, the answer I get from many people is, well, I guess we just won't know until we get our new investigation. And they use that as a way to kind of kick the can down the road, as if we don't need to worry about a lot of these things. It's all going to come out in the investigation. So I think the Pentagon is very important, as most people on this call know how I feel about this, because it is a direct link to the perpetrators, much more so than the WTC. And I think that, you know, pretending that we're going to have this new investigation really just leaves us in a kind of a, of course it's a more happy thought to hold, but it doesn't get us anywhere, and we have to start facing reality about this. And that's, I guess, all I have to say.
Okay, thank you.
Lorenzo, staff.
We got you on the end of the list, Lorenzo, when we get there. So let's see, I think Michael, is it Michael Booth? Is that right?
Michael
Booth? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's move on to Michael Cook.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I don't know how it can happen. I think it's unwise to close down any avenues of pursuit. I think the legal one is, you know, definitely has a lot of potential. We've just had papers filed in New Jersey by a very good attorney who's very interested in seeing something happen. The more people who wake up to the evidence that are in the system, that are judges and prosecutors and lawyers and stuff, the odds just increase every year that something is going to break, because they got to, you know, do their jobs, and they don't want their kids growing up in an insane world like this. Regarding revolution, you know, I'm all for it. I don't know what you do to bring it about. I think it has to be peaceful. You know, it can't be violent, because that would just go no place we'd want to go. And I'm questioning this recent purge of high-level military brass, including, I think, 10 generals, a bunch of colonels and majors and stuff. I'm wondering if there wasn't possibly a military coup forming. A lot of us have been kind of hoping and praying for that, you know, that the military, the good people in the military, because there are some, would wake up to this evidence and see what's going on. They can smell World War III coming, and they don't want to be part of it, and, you know, 9/11 stinks to high heaven, and Israel's wrecking the world and all, and they might have been planning something, and the, you know, administration got wind of it and canned them. I don't know that that's what happened, but it's a plausible scenario. So as depressed and dark as things seem sometimes, we should remain aware that we don't know everything that's going on. And all of the efforts that we make, they're not going to do any harm. You know, we're definitely making progress. It's easier and easier for people to accept this information every day that goes by. And we've got an awful lot of people on board already, and we'll probably never have everybody, but we don't need everybody. We just need a whole hell of a lot more than we've got. And thank you.
Okay, thank you. Robin?
Yes, first a quick comment to Craig, if you would, when you list me on this call. My organization is World Peace Through 9/11 Truth, which is a segue right into your comments, Elias. I think there is a revolution going on, and you say that 9/11 is pretty much behind us, which to my point is bunk. And the way we foment and help the peaceful revolution is we get better and better information and distribute it to the masses. So I find it very interesting when things are starting to get good, we have a bunch of voices out there, some credible, some not, that say, all right, let's stop studying that and whatever. I consider this to be gatekeeping. So do you understand that your comments that the 9/11, you know, truth is a done deal on your part can be considered gatekeeping?
Okay, I understand your position. I'm sorry if it appears to be gatekeeping. I did not mean that. Of course, anybody who would continue to study 9/11 has my blessing, and it's all very well. I just want because I think that the 9/11 truth people who are really serious about it are extremely committed to our society. They are extremely committed to peace and to justice, and I find it is a little bit a waste of energy to go into the details and like people who are studying crime while the world is burning. This is just a question of priorities. So if people feel that they need to research more 9/11, please go do that. I spend more time now studying the phenomenon of the false flag all over the world, and I'm trying to work on these false flag operations in other countries and try to connect them also to social and political struggle. So I'm in Germany, for instance, member of an organization which is anti-imperialist, fighting against U.S. imperialism. I find many people in this organization extremely interested in this kind of subject, so I could relate to them. I think it is important to connect 9/11 to the general political struggle. This is what I meant. And please don't misunderstand me.
Okay, very good. I was very worried that we went to a meeting with Davidson and Chomsky broke out.
No.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. Elizabeth, do you have a comment or question? *6 if you're muted, Elizabeth. Okay, Lorenzo?
Thank you. First of all, I keep on hearing the word a new investigation when I believe that the term should be a real investigation, and at the same time, there has been and are ongoing real investigations done by pilots, done by architects and engineers. CIT has done a lot of interviews with eyewitnesses on the day of the event. So the idea that that there can actually be a prosecution with all the interference that's being run by the debunkers and the anti-truthers who are still trying to convince the masses that it was what the 9/11 Commission said, which is one of the most outrageous and ridiculous in quotes investigations I've ever heard of. It seems almost at times that just the education, the ability to have the majority of the people get that in order for this to have happened, there had to be minimally complicity, complicity by members, of the government at the and industry at the highest levels. The other thing relates to the devices that were used, which of course point to the world government, members of the of government in specific countries at the highest level, in order to get stuff like the nanothermite, or if there was some sort of
Lorenzo, excuse me, you came late in the call, but we're limited to a minute in this section of the call for our comment.
Okay, the lengthy the rant. I'll just back off and let the first part of that question go. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Well, I know Barbara wanted to do a follow-up question, and maybe some others did, and maybe anybody who was called on and wasn't able to respond would also like a chance. So we'll go down the list one more time on this. Barbara, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Elias, I would just like to encourage you to open your mind a little bit more to the possibility of genuine 9/11 justice in a legitimate court of law. I believe that the paradox here and the irony is that because of your work and your book, we are much closer, in my opinion, to being able to succeed in a legitimate legal forum of some kind. There were some 80 countries whose citizens were victims of 9/11, and it is hard for me to believe, and I do not believe, that all the governments of all 80 of them are complicit in this imperialist agenda that's led by the United States and NATO and Israel. That's number one. So I'm very positive about moving to 9/11 justice at this point. In fact, I feel that the D.C. conference that we just had in September, around the anniversary of this 12th anniversary, was a major turning point in moving towards actual legal justice. And then my last comment is that I believe that the opening, and Professor Graham McQueen and I agree on this, and Barry Kissin, we believe that the anthrax attacks are actually probably the most probable entry into getting real 9/11 justice. And that is because the United States government has actually officially acknowledged that the anthrax attacks were a inside job. So that's my comment. I want to encourage you to reconsider that the door is closed to legal justice. Thank you very much.
Okay. Did you want to respond to that, Elias?
Yes, sure. Just a short comment. I don't object to anybody who wants to try to go the legal way. In fact, I would even support anybody who would try to institute legal proceedings, he would have my support. I just don't believe that it is realistic, because don't forget that 9/11 was a very important event for Wall Street, for the big corporations. It was the entire capitalist system had its stakes involved. And if you're going to do that, it will mean if the courts will go and open that Pandora's box, it would mean basically upheaval of this capitalist system, and no judge is going to risk his life to do that. This is just my opinion, but if somebody wants to try it, he has my blessing, he has my support, no problem about that. I just don't believe it's realistic. I think, you see, internationally, one statesman, one single statesman, I mean president in the entire world, dared to suggest an international inquiry about 9/11. It was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. Now he is not anymore in power. He was the only state leader who dared to suggest that. There was no country, not even Russia, suggested anything of that kind. This shows how important it is and how difficult it is to bring that into even the level of an investigation, let alone a legal trial. So, but any, I don't think that it is bad to try, but I don't believe that you will get very, very far with that. But if you want to try, please do it, and you will have my support.
Thank you, Elias. Paul, did you have anything else? Paul Zaremka? Star 6 if you're muted, Paul. James Hufford?
No, lots of thoughts, but I really don't have any comment at this point.
Okay, thanks. Barry?
No, this has been a very rich discussion, and I have voluminous notes here, and I thank Elias again, and I think the whole idea of having these special telecons has been very, very good. The experience has been very, very good so far.
John Spitzler?
No, nothing else.
Martin McGee? Star 6 if you're muted, Martin. Craig, are you back with us yet? Star 6, Craig? Barton Bruce?
Are we in general now, or can I just jump?
No, we're not in general. We're going to go in general since we're done with this list. We're almost there.
Yep. Okay, thanks.
Michael Booth? Sheila?
Yeah, hi, Elias. I do have one comment. And it has... Hello?
You're still on.
Okay. It has to do with... I'm not sure I heard everything you said on this topic, but we were talking about why you were convinced that that real people died, that all the people who died... It sounds like you said all the people who died on the planes were really real and all the family members were real. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes.
He affirmed that, Sheila.
Oh, he did. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell you that I did a lot of research around Sandy Hook and also the Boston bombing, and both less than a year old. And I concluded with Sandy Hook that many of those children never existed in the first place, and that many of the people that were so-called parents were in fact actors who lived in other places. And so really it's amazing the level of deception that our fascist overlords will go to in terms of just creating identities. They can pull people together. They can have a couple of actors that say, you know, this is Mrs. Miller, this is Mr. Miller, this little kid is Bobby Miller, who's no longer with us, and they can say these people are from Sandy Hook, and who is to say they're not? Because nobody knows everybody in a town, and you know, just as if somebody told me that someone who lives on my street had died, well, if they lived a few blocks away and I'd never met them, I would just assume it's someone I'd never met. So I just wanted to interject that thought that I think that the fact, you know, I think that some of those funerals that they did for Sandy Hook, I think that they may well have just been empty caskets, and that it may just have been them renting a church, renting actors, and putting on a show. I cannot prove that, but that seems to me to be the way the evidence is leaning. So wanted to, you know, kind of throw that in, throw that thought in there.
Okay. You want to comment on that, Elias, or no?
No, well, just thank you for the tip. I would think about it. I don't reject it out of hand. No.
Okay, thank you. Michael Cook? Robin Horton?
Yes, Elias. Just anecdotal information for you regarding one of the topics that started with Bolin. I do a lot of street activity. I have signs that relate 9/11 to Israel, and whenever I'm in pedestrian areas up here in the Pacific Northwest, 4 out of 5 times when I'm in the street, I get a visit by a friendly person who calls them, who admits that they are Jewish and are offended by my whole thing and blah, 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 blah. So, and I am, it's very interesting to me and sort of have some fun with the fact that every time that the voices do get raised about Israel's connection with 9/11, we get a visit. I consider this teleconference to Christopher Bolin getting a visit. Thank you.
Okay. Elizabeth, are you back on the call? And Lorenzo. Do you have anything else to add, Lorenzo? Okay, then let's move into our final discussion then. This is open, huh?
Hello, Lorenzo. Hello. Back. Just for your information.
Okay.
Yeah, my dog was barking and I star sixed out.
Thank you. Okay, so do you want to add anything on this topic? The question of political dynamic and so forth?
No, that's pretty well it.
Okay, thank you. All right, so let's move into our open-ended discussion then. This will be the final part of the call. And we'll do this by open-ended stacking of speakers. So who would like to make a general comment or a question, have a further question of any sort for Elias?
Robin,
your name. I didn't hear it.
Robin on the stack.
Robin, who else?
Sheila on the stack.
Sheila, who else?
Barton. But
Barbara, who else?
It was Barton also, but can you kind of shut up whoever's, there's some background yelling going on somewhere still that's going to mess up.
Yeah, somebody's got some background noise going on, and it would be nice if they would star six so that the rest of us don't need to hear it. Thank you. Who else besides Robin, Sheila, Barbara, and Barton would like to be on?
Lorenzo.
Lorenzo, okay. Who else? Okay, well, let's get started with that then. Robin, you're first. So still try to keep your comment or question to roughly a minute, please. Go ahead.
One quick comment is that whoever is making noise is still online.
Yeah, I know. Please star six if you have background noise, and then you can star six to come back when you want to speak.
Okay, a general comment from most of the people on this this call, and then I'll be under a minute here, and then a specific question. Anybody who is interested in looking, and again, I'm an air traffic controller, sort of part of my deal. Anybody interested in the BTS surveys about America 11, American 77 not being scheduled need to look into why BTS, it's a statistical thing, exists in the first place. In order to know whether those aircraft were scheduled to fly that day or not, you have to interrelate with the actual airline, the actual flight plan that was filed into the FAA computers, and they are all intact. So BTS is a function that is different than people are giving it credit for. Sort of on the same ATC line or thing, here's a question for you, Elias. I watched the videotapes that Ken provided here, and I noticed that you made a statement that you feel that 2 aircraft were still airborne, and I want to ask your information source, most specifically, is it directly from only from pilots for 9/11 Truth and through the ATARS information, which, again, referring to my first question, is just a matter of a printed sheet with stuff on it. ATARS.
Well, the sources are documents of the 9/11 Commission stored to the National Archives. So it is. I was pointed out to these sources by the pilots for 9/11, and I went to the source of the information, which was documents of the 9/11 Commission. Now, I don't know if these documents are authentic, but I assume that they are from official sources.
Why do you assume they are when others are?
I assume that the 9/11 Commission would get these reports from official sources. I mean, these are ACCAR's lists, and the persons who made these lists are also identified, and there are discussions with people who said these are, I mean, it's all documented in the documents of the 9/11 Commission and in interviews with people. So I don't have it out in my head now, but you can consult it in my book.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Sheila?
Yeah. Now, this may be a question that nobody has an answer to, but I always feel it's good to bring it up anyway. How do we get people to wake up? It is so frustrating to me that even people who I've known for years, even many of my own family members, when I try to talk to them about 9/11 or other false flag events, they simply believe what they saw on CNN or what they saw on Fox News, and they won't believe me. And I know I'm not the only one who feels this way, but it is so frustrating. And it seems like we're really just up against we're between a rock and a hard place, because the brainwashing is so complete, and the matrix that we live in is so tightly woven, it is so difficult for people to break out of that. And yet some of us apparently were able to do it. So I'm just wondering if anyone has an insight into what does it take? Why is it that some of us are able to, like in my case, like I said earlier, it's just 48 hours from when I totally believed the official story to I totally knew it was 100% false. Some of us are able to make that turnaround, others are not. And I don't think it's related to intelligence, because many of the people I'm thinking of are very bright people. And yet, without waking up more people, we have no hope of really changing things. So if anyone has an insight, I would be happy to hear it.
Could I respond?
Elias, would you like to respond to that?
No, I don't. I'm not a good psychologist. But I usually compare 9/11 to the denial of a wife of a sexual predator. When a husband is sexually mishandling his daughters, usually the wives don't want to know about it and don't want to see that, even if it is in front of her eyes. This kind of denial is now a massive denial in entire nations. And I don't know how to deal with this kind of sickness. I don't know.
That's very honest. Who said they wanted to respond to this? Because I'll put you on the stack, and then you can respond to it when it's your turn. Who said they wanted to respond?
John Spritzler.
This is James. I'd also like to respond.
Oh, John and then James. Okay, so the next person on the stack was Barbara.
Yes, hi, Elias. Thank you so much again. I would just appreciate your letting us all know the best email for you, if you could tell us now.
I'm sorry.
Your email address, Elias, she's asking for?
Oh, I see. Oh, it is such a long one. It would be complicated to tell you. You go on my website, rather. You just Google my name with Davidson with two S's. Google my name, find my website, and send me a mail through the website.
Well, would you be willing to give us your email address?
Well, it is. I can do it, but it is. It will take some time because I have to spell it.
Could you send it to Ken or somebody?
Yeah.
Or
Barrett?
Yeah.
Send it to
Ken. Could you? Yeah. If you email it, Elias, to myself or Craig, we'll make sure it goes into the report of this conference, and then
good,
anybody
good.
Who wants to follow up can, okay?
Yeah.
I think I probably have it anyway, but just in case, it would be good to have it for me, and then we can put it in the minutes. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barb. Martin?
Yeah. I don't know which place to start. This wake-up thing, I'll just toss in something that maybe sounds a little bit far-fetched, but it isn't. Ingo Swann, who's now dead, who Barbara knew, has a book called Penetration. You might find it's 160-page enlightening. With it or after it, you might want to read Bernays' classic book. They tie together on sort of a group mind think, mass mind control, and all that. If you think of, you know, large flocks of swallows all flying in beautiful patterns and, you know, without, you know, at high speed, or all the sheep are running around paying attention to whatever they get brainwashed for on TV. But I wanted to jump back to other things about, like, the upper brass being fired. On the day of Benghazi, apparently they waited for the CIA guy there to, slash ambassador, to call some of his buddies. And he called two flag rank officers. One was a Marine Corps general and the other was an admiral. And certainly the admiral was led off his carrier in handcuffs that day. And I think something bad happened to the Marine Corps guy too. And I'm not sure who were the good guys and who were the bad guys in that. But you go back to TWA Flight 800, there were flag rank officers heading to a meeting, I think probably in Paris, but maybe kind of meeting that would not be a good thing to have in the United States. And so there's been revolutions of some kind, or I won't say coup d'etat, but you know, some sort of people concerned who want to make changes who get stopped with major warnings and don't do that. I mean, the Lockerbie bombing was killed three FBI agents and three some other agency guys who were coming back with all kinds of real drug samples and documentation about CIA and people drug running stuff out of Afghanistan. So those guys had to be taken out and the others had to be warned. So this goes on all the time. And all those recently fired brass, some people cynically say, well, the acid test they were asked is, if you push came to shove, would you be willing to shoot Americans? And if they say no, you're fired. And if they say sure, then they probably are still in the military. But who knows? And then, well, that's enough. I'm certainly beyond a minute. There's plenty more, but that's fine. Or if you want, I will talk more. But I think I'm about the time I'm going to be shut off.
Next.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Before we go, who wrote the book Penetration?
Oh, that's Ingo Swann. He was a very psychic person. He was worked at SRI for many, many years.
S-W-A-N-N?
That is correct.
Okay.
He's got other books, but the one I'm referring to is Read Penetration. If it helps you when you're reading to think of it as a novel, that's fine. It's more than a novel, but you can think of it as a novel couched as a personal experience.
All right, thanks. Lorenzo, you're next.
This is Barbara, and I knew Ingo personally. People just need to know before they put the time into Reading Penetration, which is very enlightening, that it is about telepathy.
Yes, but he had this term telepathy plus, and please don't jump around in the book. That you might be tempted to look ahead, but you need to take you to where he's going at the far end, because the book brings out all kinds of other stuff, but he's really trying to get you to be aware of something that he became aware of sort of in the later years that he considers very relevant, and that's what he calls telepathy plus. But it really is getting into group mind think, if you will, and communication between beings or remote perceptions that some people are aware of and other people are not. And the group mind control and the mass marketing or pushing of it by government agencies may be very relevant, and certainly using the stuff that media uses.
This is James. I found it on Amazon, and the cheapest used copy is $233.
Oh, come on. I mean, I'll mail you the PDF. I mean,
I'd love it.
No, it's free online.
Yeah,
it's free online. You can find the PDF. I'm Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N at barton.net. If someone wants penetration, let me know. I can also send you the Bernays PDF at the same time.
Okay.
Thanks, Barton. Okay. Lorenzo, you're next.
Thank you. I just want to reiterate how important I think sticking very close to the day of the event and paying attention to some of the, you know, authentic videos, to the journalists' comments on the day. There's just so much that, you know, after the day of 9/11, especially after the fall of Building Number 7, the next day you didn't hear anything about it. So, you know, everything that came after that is hearsay and allegation and interpretation and speculation and some real science when it comes to what the architects and engineers and pilots have done. I just want to reiterate how important it is to study the stuff that happened on that day and not really count on any of the allegations that were made after that date as being true or information. A lot of it contains mis- or disinformation, and you know, please pay attention to what happened in the morning and the afternoon. That's my comment.
Including Duffy, who said the Air Force shot down an airliner over Pennsylvania.
John, you're next.
I just wanted to say that in regards to this question about how come people don't see the truth, that 9/11 is, you know, false flag. I understand the frustration of having a very intelligent friend who refuses to even consider the possibility. It's very frustrating, but I think it's important to keep in mind that far, far more Americans are skeptical of the 9/11 story or disbelieving of it than we generally tend to know about or think or hear. And the people who are most likely to accept the 9/11 story, the government story, in my experience, are the people who are higher up economically, more in the academic or professional, I call the NPR listening demographic, and the people who are much more likely to be skeptical or disbelieving of it are the people who are lower socioeconomically in the United States. And whenever they, you know, whenever there's a lot of evidence that there's a large degree of skepticism, I think that what we should work on is the premise that most people know very well we don't have a real democracy, would love a revolution, but don't know that they're in a majority in thinking that way, feel they're in a tiny, hopelessly small and weak minority. David Graeber just wrote an article about that relates to this, which I highly recommend. It's called Buncombe, B-U-N-C-O-M-B, on the Baffler. If you Google that with his name, David Graeber, G-R-A-E-B-E-R. It's about how most people know the lies that we're told are lies, but they don't know that everybody else also knows it. It's important to keep in mind that fact.
Okay, thanks. And James.
I just wanted to relate to Sheila. My experience talking to people is that a lot of people would be willing to accept the evidence of 9/11 false flag, but they just feel that the people pulling the strings on those things are 10 miles or 100 miles above their head, and there's just no way that they could do anything at all about it. They're just resigned to whatever happens.
Okay.
Robin called on the stack. I think you missed me, Ken.
No, you were first, Robin.
Not in response to this question of that Sheila
brought up. No. We were going down a stack, but I'll put you back on the stack if you want to go. Anybody else want to go back on the stack? Go ahead, Robin.
Yeah, I think that the cognitive dissonance issue was handled very well by architects and engineers. So we have a vehicle out there. But the big thing is like 85% of people in the United States suspect the JFK, you know, or feel that the government is covering up or was involved in the JFK assassination. We need to just persist. Also, I might want to point out that the loose change guy's work has been seen by so many millions of younger people, and so really we sometimes get blocked up where with the older people who are cognitively dissonant about everything, okay? So, you know, they're going to have to die and pass off. We just have to keep this thing alive, and it's so disturbing for me to hear, you know, somebody say, hey, now where we are, 9/11, let's pack up our tents and go. No, this is just getting good. So the revolution is on.
I agree.
This is Ken. Segueing on what Robin said there, I want to remind everyone that from our previous teleconference that the conference in Dallas on the Kennedy assassination will be live streamed, and you can see that this coming weekend on politicalassassinations.com has the link for the live stream. Okay, if anybody's interested in that. Anybody else want to say anything before we close out?
Yeah.
Barton? I'd like to say one more thing. This is Sheila.
Okay, Sheila. Anybody else?
Barton.
Okay. Go ahead, Sheila.
Barbara.
Yeah, in reference to what a couple of people have said here, I think it's probable that I live in an area where we probably have a very low percentage of people who are willing to speak out about 9/11. For one, the county I live in is the highest per capita income county in the United States. So if people at the higher income levels are less likely to see the truth, well, then I'm living at basically ground zero for people who can't see the truth. And the other thing is I'm just outside of D.C., and there's a very large percentage of people around here who are employed in one way or another by the government or by government contractors. So they could be in some way, they might feel their job would be at risk if they, you know, would speak up against the government. So it's probable that things are better, that are actually going better than I can see here from where I sit. I'd like to think that. I'd like to think, you know, in places like California, maybe they are having more success, but for those of us right here in D.C., it's, you know, it's pretty tough going, really.
Sheila, who would have guessed?
Yeah. Barton?
Okay, I'm gonna go back to the Israeli connection because it's all over the place, and the our government being involved in everything, but it also seems Congress is totally controlled, and I think the only thing that controls Congress is certainly not their constituent, but it's Israel. They either have videos of them doing things they shouldn't do, or they give them money, or they let them on the radio stations and TV stations that they totally control. This is, and it's not Israel totally itself doing it. It's Americans who are Zionists, and it's the big, you know, 600-pound gorilla that no one dares speak the name of in the room, and that's beginning to slip. People will say it occasionally, and it's been said on this thing conference already, and it just needs to be said more. And there's a lot of, I mean, there's Jewish Voice for Peace and other people who are certainly very aware of things like this and who are trying really hard for peace and trying to work in the opposite direction. There's somebody like Amico Pellet, who's got a couple of books out, The General Son and The Return of the General Son. He's a very clear-thinking guy, and they don't call him a self-hating Jew because of who his family is. His father was a very famous Jewish general who became pacifist, and liked the Palestinians, and they forgave him, I think. And his grandfather was one of the founders of Israel, one of the signers or whatever. And they can't quite call him self-hating Jew, although I'm sure there's a whole lot of people who would like to. There's a lot of good people trying to work the other direction. It isn't certainly all Jewish people that are bad. It's just Zionists who will do outrageous stuff that they're doing. Anyway, that's I mean, there's people like that, Dmitry Kahelizov, or however you pronounce his name, the former Russian intelligence guy. No one's mentioned. He's got interesting stuff and interesting points of view, essentially about high energy technology used during 9/11, and I don't think he can just be dismissed casually. He certainly mentions lots of, and there's lots of buildings that were seriously damaged that AE-911 Truth just doesn't even talk about. And I understand the reasons to talk only about, Building 7 for the most part. I'm on the AE-911 Truth cable TV team, so I'm well aware of a lot of the stuff that goes on in the organization. Anyway, that's enough.
Okay. Well, on that note, unless somebody got something vital to say, who?
No, Barbara?
Lyons, can I say a word?
I can't hear who's saying. I can't hear.
Barbara was on the
Elias.
Staff.
Elias. I'm sorry, Elias. Go ahead. Yes, please.
No, I mean, I don't want to push myself, but I'd like to say some words.
Please. Go ahead, and then after you're done, okay. I will let Barbara go on. Go ahead. Elias.
Okay. I would like to bring up 2 points. First of all, a technical one, which has not been mentioned and is rarely mentioned in the 9/11 movement, including by the architects and engineers, the fact that more than 1,100 victims of the World Trade Center, they did not find anything, not a piece of, not anything of these people. They are completely vanished, and nobody in the 9/11 movement has basically tried to inquire what kind of energy can pulverize, transform 1,100 people into fine dust within a couple of seconds. I don't know what kind of energy can do that. And it is interesting that nobody has really researched that question. This is just a fact which has been published by the New York Times, that more than 1,100 people have vanished completely. This is one point. Another point is concerning Israel. See, I am Jewish. My parents are Jews from Germany who immigrated to Palestine. I was brought up in Palestine before the State of Israel was established. I became an anti-Zionist already when I was 19 years old, and I have been an anti-Zionist since then. I am also a co-founder of the Association Iceland-Palestine, where I lived in Iceland. So I am struggling against the State of Israel. I don't accept the legitimacy of the Jewish state. So I have absolutely no sympathy for the Israeli state. And I am quite aware of all the crimes committed by the Israeli state, by the Mossad, false flag operations, and what have you. So it is not a question of the fact that I don't consider the Israelis having power through AIPAC and other organizations over American foreign policy. Of course they have, and it is very well established. The question is, in my mind, rather the other way. Can we basically consider Israel as a 51st state? Insofar, I believe that Israel is considered by many Israelis and by many American Jews essentially as a part of the United States system. Insofar, it is the interest of the United States and of the Zionist organization are just the same interests. And insofar, it is interesting to note that all the American billionaires, they support the same thing, even if so they are not Jewish. So basically, it is not a question of being Jewish or not being Jewish, as I said before. It is a question of whether you are a billionaire, a millionaire, a billionaire, and then you have certain interests. And the interest of those billionaires is to secure American hegemony in the world. And Israel is, of course, supporting that. Israel is dependent upon the United States. So it's not a question of some Jewish cabal. It is a question that the billionaires, of which there are quite a few Jews, are altogether interested in 9/11 and in carrying out these kind of operations. This is how I feel about it.
Thank you, Elias. Barbara, you wanted to make a comment?
Question, actually. Elias, I have two quick final questions, and then I'll follow up in an email exchange with you. My first question is, in your book, you make the point that as of 2002, there were no Flight 11 or 175 passenger remains that had been identified at Ground Zero, from Ground Zero. My first question is that still true today, to your knowledge? That's number one. And my second question is, if there is a legitimate legal forum that we are able to establish in the future for a real 9/11 investigation, are you willing to be an expert witness? Thank you.
I cannot be an expert witness because I am just learning the facts from the internet and from all kinds of documents. So I'm not an expert in that sense. I'm just a scholar like anybody else.
Well, would you be willing to testify?
Yeah. I would not be willing to go to the United States. I will not take a risk of going to the United States.
Okay. And the other question was, thank you. The other question was, to your knowledge, is it still the case that no Flight 11 or Flight 175 passenger remains have yet been found in the debris at Ground Zero?
I don't have evidence in either direction. I don't have evidence in saying that they were found or that they were not found. I'm agnostic about it.
Right, but in your book you say as of 2002, there were no remains from passengers of 11 or 175 that had been found as of 2002. So you still stand by that?
Oh, yes. If I said it in the book, probably I researched it and probably it was correct, yeah.
All right. Thank you. You don't have knowledge since then. Okay. Thank you very much, Elias.
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody else have anything to add or subtract from the conversation here?
Robin?
Okay. Anybody besides Robin? Because then I think we want to kind of bring this to a close. Anybody else want to make a final comment?
Barton, if I can stick one last thing in.
Okay. Robin and Barton, anybody else?
Okay, I'll jump in. Lorenzo.
Robin, Barton, and Lorenzo. Anybody else?
Paul also.
Okay, Paul? Robin. Robin, Barton, Lorenzo, then Paul. Go ahead, Robin.
Yes, I can't remember the fellow who talked about the power of how much influence Israel has in the United States politically, and whoever it was said that they had videotapes, they had this, they had that, or whatever it might be. I just want to inform, I'm sort of a political maven for decades now. Sophia Shafkoff sent me a YouTube connection to a YouTube video years ago that was actually fronting our famous Richard Perle. And in that video, he made the point that AIPAC and the ADL in this country had political infrastructure in place, regardless of political party, in every congressional district and senatorial district in the United States of America. And he boasted basically that if somebody wants to get elected in any of those districts, either party, they pretty much had to go through this group. So this is an infrastructure that has been put into place over the decades, and it sits there right now. The panic and cry about corporate money and, you know, affecting politics, that's all a front. Bottom line of the story is the political structure, okay, that actually is used to elect people. That's how they have their control. Thank you. That's all.
Okay. Barton?
Okay, just continuing on with what he just said, in fact, not only that, but they have now got not all, but a lot of the higher positions in major universities and institutions, and that's why you're seeing, another reason you're seeing suppression of any kind of research into this kind of stuff. and that kind of thing. I just wanted to jump back to Israel's involvement or things and games they play to try to cover things up. And the Dakota Report, which looked as though it was a damning thing, but it was, you know, all kinds of poison pills in there. So it was, you know, interesting reading, but clearly couldn't all be true. But it was the kind of thing that you could think of someone putting out there, a spin doctor putting out there, to hope you get your arms around and say, wow, look at all this good stuff. It's absolutely perfect stuff, and it proves Israel was involved. And then all they do is start showing the poison pills to be total lies, and so pretty soon you're a totally discredited idiot who believed all this garbage. And but who would go to that trouble to do something like that unless it was someone trying to create yet other layers of things which they could discredit just to protect them? So that when someone starts leaking stuff like that, you would sometimes suspect that they, in fact, are indeed involved in protecting themselves. Okay. If anybody doesn't know what the Dakota Report is, you can find it online. Pilots for 9/11 Truth got a copy, and AE 9/11 Truth got copy that they scanned at too high a resolution, so it's hard to email because it's pretty big, but it's the same document.
Okay.
I have copies of both, including the scan of the manila envelope AE 911 Truth got it in, actually.
Okay. Lorenzo?
Hey, thank you. I'd like to reiterate that the devil is in the details, and there's a lot of stuff that a lot of people haven't really seen or paid attention to, or things that people have come into denial about, or possibly the speculation or the idea that I'm seeing something that other people aren't seeing might not even be there. There's a lot of import in some of the details that have to do with the events in New York and at the Pentagon that I think really need to be looked at least paid attention to by people who haven't really paid that much attention to them yet or responded, or, you know, that I'll just leave it at that for now, and I'll be in a conversation hopefully with more people about some of the stuff that I've been paying attention to.
Okay, thank you. And Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, the only comment I would make is this use of the word revolution. I refer people back to the 1930s, even the early 1930s. In Germany, you might have been hearing a lot of language about revolution, and it was not coming just from the left. It was coming from the right. The Nazi program is basically a revolutionary program, as is other programs that are working class oriented. So I think if we're going to talk about revolution, we certainly can't do that today, but we have to be careful what we're talking about. That's all.
Okay.
And
on that note, nonviolent, right? Okay, I think I speak for the rest of the callers, Elias, in thanking you for spending so much time with us today and enlightening us further about the really sedulous research that you've accumulated and published. And we wish you the best in your future literary endeavors, and look forward to your coming work. And thank you again for spending the time with us today.
Thank you, Elias.
Thank you,
Elias.
Thank you,
Ken.
Yeah.
Okay,
we'll see you all last Wednesday, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I think. Bye-bye.
Right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Right.